Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. Today I have with me Bart Harvey. Bart Harvey joined Enterprise Foundation soon after its founding in June 1984 and succeeded James Rouse as chairman and CEO in October 1993. In January 2007, he turned over CEO of Enterprise Community Partners to Doris Koo, the first executive director of Asian Americans for Equality. In March 2008, Mr. Harvey retired as chairman of Enterprise Community Partners and Enterprise Community Investment. Enterprise is a leading provider of capital and expertise for affordable housing and community development. Enterprise works with partners, developers, investors, government, and primarily community-based nonprofits and has raised and invested over $9 billion that has produced over 240,000 homes for low-income households. Enterprise continues to shape ways to ensure better outcomes for low-income families, such as by bringing together leaders from the environmental and community development fields to create the Green Communities SM Initiative in 2004. This $555 million initiative has far exceeded its five-year goal of building more than 8,500 affordable homes that promote health, conserve energy and natural resources, and promote easy access to jobs, schools, and services. Mr. Harvey was appointed by Congress to the Millennium Housing Commission from 2000 to 2002 and has been a director of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Atlanta, as well as on the advisory boards for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He has served on numerous boards, including the Baltimore Education Scholarship Trust, Center Stage, the National Housing Conference, National Housing Trust, and Shepherd's Clinic. Most recently, Mr. Harvey was chosen as the 2008 recipient of the Urban Land Institute J.C. Nichols Prize for Visionaries in Urban Development, as well as the National Housing Conference's 2008 Housing Person of the Year. Before joining Enterprise for 10 years, Mr. Harvey worked in domestic and international positions for the investment bank Dean Witter Reynolds, now Morgan Stanley, leaving as managing director of corporate finance. He has an MBA and an BA from Harvard University and lives in Baltimore with his wife and three children. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Bart.
Thank you, Dave, very much.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, it's a little bit of an unusual trajectory of a career. Started out after college, having written a thesis on Wordsworth and the French Revolution. I went overseas for my first job. I made $1,800 a year working in the bowels of a merchant bank in England so I could rewalk Wordsworth's wonderful walks where he created his poems. I got interested from that job in investing, went back to business school, and started on Wall Street, and then after about 10 years, decided it was time to give a little bit back, not only in money, we had plenty of that, but in time, and came back and met Jim Rouse, and he had just started the Enterprise Foundation. And that quick lunch, where I had lunch with him, and he was going to change the world and provide housing for every low-income person in this country, in the United States. I said, he's crazy, he's out of his mind, but I can do that for 6 months, and signed up for 6 months, and that lasted 23 years. And he's totally changed the direction of my life and a lot of my belief system along the way. So he was a wonderful mentor. And then I left and turned over Enterprise in 2008 and joined the Obama campaign. And then after that, I was appointed by Obama to work out Fannie Mae when it first declared bankruptcy and went into conservatorship. And I've been working at that for 5 years since, and then joined a lot of boards, eight other boards of things I really care about at this point in my life. So that basically is a career study for Bart Harvey.
Give me some bullet points of some high moments for you in the history of Bart Harvey.
There was a couple of high moments which ended up changing the direction of my career in unusual ways. And I just point that out for others. The first high point was in investment banking. I was asked to look at reorganizing what had been the old food fair, which was in bankruptcy, and had the brilliant idea and looked at all the rules and figured out that we could go down and sell a division of theirs, a profitable division in Florida, but that the real estate was worth more than the business was. at that point in bankruptcy, if you shut down a division, the people lost all their pensions. And yet we figured out we could make four times the money that the business was by using the real estate. So we gave the great advice, it got shut down. We came out of that with many million dollars of fees, and I was a hero, and I got a huge bonus, and I then had to go down and meet the people that were basically being fired, and they were operating a perfectly fine business, and they were in their 50s, and they had kids, and I looked at them, and I said, obviously this was good advice to the company from an economic point of view. I was made a hero by it. But these guys are out of a job, and it's not likely that they're going to change in their late 50s. And they have no pensions. All the pensions were canceled out. And so being a hero wasn't such a great thought. And it really started me thinking about what are the morals concerns of doing business. That is completely ethical because it was legal, but is that really ethical that you can do something legal?
Right.
And so that's really started me to say, I want to give some time back as well as money. This is very gingerly done, and serendipity sort of happened right at that point in time. There's a headhunter who wanted me to become a partner of Salomon Brothers at that point, and I said, I don't want that. I really want to go do something that gives back. And he said, well, I just had dinner with Jim Rouse last night, and he's just started this foundation. Why don't you meet with him? And so that's what I did. And it was, and that started, you know, the bulk of my career.
Tell us some of the projects you did with Jim Rouse.
Well, Jim is an extraordinary person. I've never, ever met anybody like him. And so he thought, why not? Why shouldn't people have opportunity? He sort of started very differently than you started in investment banking, which is, how do you line up all the success factors so when you take risk, the odds are stacked with you to succeed? He started the other way around of saying, why should we permit conditions to be the way they are? And why can't we change this? And so he was totally antithetical to my Harvard Business School training. He didn't think the right way. And I'm going to answer that question. But there's a very funny story that occurred where he said, okay, Bart, this is the Enterprise Social Investment Corporation, because we have to finance housing at below market rates in order to keep it low cost to the person and affordable to people that are going to buy that housing. I said, well, great. What are your products to do that with? He said, well, we haven't invented them yet. And so we started. So I started in on that end of the business with a wonderful Baltimorean who was had been commissioner of housing, Mark Sisman, to create the products that we needed to do affordable housing. And basically, Jubilee Housing was a mission outgrowth of a group in D.C. that wanted to change conditions there. And then there was a Jubilee Baltimore that was up here, which still exists today, that was working in Butcher Hill. And we looked at these nonprofit groups that were going house by house in neighborhoods where people had united together and said, we want conditions to get better, and who had incorporated themselves as a nonprofit and were trying to get better. But they didn't have the money, the investment, the technical expertise necessarily that they needed, but they knew exactly what homes were vacant, what homes needed to change, where the drug dealers were, how you could change a neighborhood, and were willing to put themselves on the line for it. And so we started there, and we started providing resources, and we listened to the people, and we backed them, primarily with Jim's reputation at the Rouse Company front and center, and basically said to them, let's start with 10 houses, or let's start with 5 houses, whatever you think you can do. And we will help you go through the whole process of real estate development. We will help you finance it. and we will provide you below cost capital to do so.
So what year was this around?
This was in 1984, and this was really in the very start of Enterprise. There were three or four people, and here's the other side of Enterprise back then. So there was a foundation, but there also was a development company. And Jim had looked around the world and said, the problem with nonprofits is that you basically have to depend on other people's generosity. But I also want to have a development company that's owned by the nonprofit so that all the profits that are made there flow into sustaining over a longer term the nonprofit. Now, he created a development company modeled on the Rouse Company, which had been hugely successful, but to go into smaller cities and to try and provide commercial opportunities and jobs and other for small businesses and for merchants and for others, and to help revitalize the downtowns of towns that were suffering. If you take that model, it didn't work out that way, as things often do not. But over time, we met our match in the development company because we took on Flint right before GE laid off and a whole number of people, and the unemployment went from 14 to
Flint, Michigan.
From 14% to somewhere north of 30%. Mm. And so our little development got swamped by the unemployment. And we took on Toledo. We took on lots of cities. Some of these were tremendously successful. Some were not. But at the same time, we were developing ways of doing affordable housing in any way that we could to make a profit and run it from a socially screened point of view. We did. And other ends of our financing all of a sudden started to make money on their own. And they became basically, more than the development company, the sort of the sustaining sum of funds that helped Enterprise, along with its help from major foundations and other sources, individuals, et cetera. But in all, we raised $9 billion before I left, and that's from starting from Zippo. And we helped over 1,000 nonprofits in some of the toughest urban areas in the United States. And the sustainability of that over time has been remarkable. Everyone said, well, these groups will fall apart. The housing will fall apart. It will be slums all over again. And that just hasn't been the case. And it's been over 30 years now. It's absolutely remarkable. And what people don't take into account, I'm not going to take Cleveland, for instance, which is a really troubled, formerly great American iconic city that fell on hard times, just like Baltimore did and Pittsburgh did when all of the jobs left, all of the good middle-class jobs left. For here in Baltimore, Maryland, it was breweries, and then it was Bethlehem Steel, and then it was Westinghouse. And in Cleveland, there were similar kinds of – there were iron ore companies and steel companies, and obviously Pittsburgh the same way. But the group of nonprofits had a way of screening people that were really going to make a go of it. They were all poor. They were all willing to – try, and they were going to get support from that group one way or another. So our housing in Cleveland has stayed occupied, very small default rate on it, and it gave people an opportunity for them and their families to be stable, to be part of a neighborhood, to get jobs in the service economy, which doesn't pay as much, but to be stable and to start raising that next generation that didn't have to go from rental to rental or from failure to failure.
And what year was this around for Cleveland?
Well, for Cleveland, we started – in Cleveland's interesting because we started in 85, and it's up to the present. And there's been several thousand units of housing done. But Cleveland was interesting because we said, okay, we've got to create this below-market financing. And there was a little part of the tax code that said you could get accelerated depreciation for rental housing. And we said, well, nonprofits can't use that accelerated depreciation because that's basically a tax advantage that rental owners had. And so we said, well, let's go to Standard Oil, which was at that time in Cleveland, and sell it to them. And they can make a return on it. And we can assure them that this housing will be good. And so we did that. It was mind-numbing. This is the first time it was done in the country. And, the CEO for a tiny little thing compared to the amounts of money that he was looking at. So what the H is this that we're investing in housing, in slum housing, he said, in Cleveland? And we said, it's not slum housing. It's good housing. It will work. We'll stand in between you and it in a partnership. Your name doesn't have to be on it. It will be an investor, but you'll be proud of it. And they were proud of it. And he came out and he saw the people and he said, my goodness, this is terrific stuff. I'm sorry to make this so long, this is the beginning of what really changed in the country. This little deal changed the country in the end. So it was in the Reagan administration, and they were in tax reform, and this was in 1986 now. So we've been doing this for a while. And in 86, they were going to do away with this code. In fact, they were going to do away with everything for rental housing, but if you had a boat, a yacht, a first house, a second house, a third house, you could get the mortgage deduction on it. And we said, well, this is a little unfair because typically renters are people who don't have enough savings or their credit isn't good enough to become a homeowner. And so you're hurting the most vulnerable people in the country. And we just started gearing this up in other places. And anyway, we prevailed against the Reagan administration. This wasn't political. In fact, it was a Republican, Senator Packwood, who was one of our great supporters on it. And with bipartisan Charlie Rangel in the House. And we created something called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which has accounted for more new rental housing than all of HUD in the period since 1986. And basically, it said you'll get a tax credit, not a deduction, and it can be used, but the investors are at risk if the properties don't work. There's recapture and penalties, and they tried to make it as I dealt with joint tax, as difficult as possible to utilize this credit. And in meeting with the joint tax, these are the staffers, they threw everything in there to say basically you could only go to corporations in essence. And they knew no corporation would take this on. So, of course, we started all over and we got Fannie Mae this time. We got Standard Oil. We got a bunch of people to take a risk on it. David Maxwell, I'll never forget, it was the CEO of Fannie Mae at that time, who had turned it around from a loss maker, losing $1 million a day to making $1 million a day. And he put $25 million into it. And I said, that's great and wonderful. And we'll do the housing and we'll prove it out. But I want you to come on the road with me, talk to other CEOs, because your credibility and the credibility of the CFO of Standard Oil and others will make a big difference. And we built a multi-billion dollar business off of that low-income housing tax credit, which in essence, it supports rental housing for people making less than 60% of whatever the area median income is, or if you want to translate it into sort of national averages, it's people making under $30,000 on down, depending on the part of the country that you're in. And the rental had to be affordable at 30% of their income, whatever their income was. And so we were reaching down, and then we said, well, we can use this for homeless housing, too. And we found ways to use home. It's a long story, but we became one of the largest providers of housing for homeless housing, for people with disabilities. is about a third of everything we did. Two-thirds were just low-income people that were working but not making enough and not making enough to provide for themselves. So between that and the home ownership that we were doing, it ended up that we put 240,000 households into permanent affordable housing. The one thing I'd say about the rental housing here is that the rates basically couldn't go up by any more than what inflation was for that area. To the naysayers who said, well, this is all going to turn into slum housing, the housing's become more valuable. And at the end of 15 years, and back then I didn't think I'd see the end of 15 years. I'd say, I don't care what happens at the end of 15 years. But we said, okay, we're going to sell it for a dollar to the nonprofit, and no one will ever make any money off of it, but it'll be an asset to the nonprofit. But I'll never be around to see it. That's, you know, when you're younger, you never, 15 years is a long time for you. Well, 15.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. That's right. So 15 years after that, these were valuable assets that were going back to the nonprofit. So now they had assets. And we also said that they get a development fee, which we had to argue for, so that they could make money on it, so that they could get a 10% development fee out of developing the housing just like for-profits did, because they were doing the same work. They had the same risk. Enterprise became a special limited partner in all of these transactions all over the country, so that if it didn't work out, we stepped in, we took the risk, and we would have to kick out the nonprofit group if they were doing something bad. We were watching over them if they weren't equipped to make the housing work. That happened in less than 5% of the cases where we had to step in. And in some cases, we had to put in technical expertise that had to go out and work with the people. But it worked. It basically, you know, this is started from Jim Rouse's, why can't we do better? We did, and we did better. And then, of course, housing, it just gives you a platform. You know, if you could have everyone today in decent, fit, sustainable, affordable housing, you still haven't addressed schools, jobs, other needs that people have. And so our nonprofit end worked on that. It worked on trying to connect people to jobs, to try to work on what else was needed in the communities. And there's a lot needed in the communities. Was there a connection to the school? And what about school reform? What about charter reform? You get into all the issues of an urban environment. And in Baltimore, we decided we ought to take on two schools just to see what we could do. And they were the worst performing in Maryland in the third and fifth grades, and the third worst performing in Maryland. And Kelson and Pinder Hughes over in Sandtown, Winchester area, over in West Baltimore. And we hired the best people we could find. We hired an African-American. These are very 99% African-American parts of Baltimore. We hired an African-American woman who had turned around a school in Chicago. We got the best educational people together that we could. We couldn't move the scores at all in the beginning. We kept trying. We had kids coming. We had the place cleaner. We invested money. We had mentors. And after about 3 years, everything started moving the right way. And they went from the worst and third worst in Maryland, not in Baltimore, in Maryland, in the state of Maryland, to the top third. And it just showed it. And this was K through six at that point. We made it K through eight, thanks to a visionary Baltimorean, Bill Strever, who ran a company and helped expand the schools. You know, you found that you could do it, but then you had to go from K through eight and your investments all the way up into high school, or you would lose all the investment that you made in these kids over time. So we had a, we basically have a high school in the area. It's a long-winded way of saying these things can change. The conditions that you see are hard. They're that way for a reason. A lot of it has to do with income and lack of connection to others. But you can change those conditions. You can help people. And by helping these people and by doing it effective, efficient way, you're helping the country. You're helping our society. That's old-fashioned. I'm called a liberal. I believe it. I've seen it. I've worked on it. I've changed my belief system. This is all from Jim Rouse, who accomplished marvelous things by not taking the conventional wisdom and by saying our journey is a journey only. We started naked. We're going to die and be under the ground. Yeah. And so what you can do in between matters, and it matters tremendously. And
it's an amazing story when you're talking about low-income housing, that if you create something for people to be able to afford their housing, it creates pride in home ownership because they'll take care of it. And that's just part of what really needs to happen, I think, in the neighborhoods. You talked about education, but also businesses have to come in and hire people locally. There's initiatives that I want to take up with this radio station, talking to people like Matt Gallagher, the Goldsecker Foundation, who talks about vacant housing, to bring everybody together. We'll get back to that. Cleveland and the Rouse Company, this is back in the 80s. How does that translate to what's happening in Baltimore City now?
We took on a major initiative. The school was one part of it in Sandtown, Winchester, which is West Baltimore. As you do in anything, you have victories and failures in this. To me, the whole thing is a victory because you're trying to make things better. And it's worth trying things, and not all of them are going to work, just like how the company started. The development company, quote, ended up a failure. We had to wind it down, but we created another investment vehicle that returned over $200 million, all socially screened, all worthwhile financing that helped the foundation grow and put it on the map. So Ford and Rockefeller, all the major foundations were investors in it in the end. And so this is in Baltimore, in West Baltimore. We really wanted to change one of the poorest neighborhoods and address everything at once, which was jobs, which was schools, which were the community itself. And it was a multi-year project. And the housing that was put in, this just goes, Dave, your comment, that was put in the heart of boarded up, abandoned buildings almost everywhere else around it, center of the drug trade in West Baltimore. And that housing today, which is community-owned or home-owned, we put in a lot of home ownership, all affordable at 30%. All the people are working one way or another or have some kind of income from disabilities, et cetera, is better today than it was when it was put in 15 years ago. So you can go over there and you will look and see the housing and the changes that occurred. There's also Murphy Homes over there. You may remember it before. Murder Homes, as it was known. And that came down, an enterprise basically through what's called a Hope 6, but put in a whole new development that attracted a mix of incomes, a middle income, as well as low income people who had lived in Murphy Homes. And the area works better. Now, the failure in that area was largely in the job side. And the difficulty of getting people connected with jobs was hard. Into deeper and deeper issues of incarceration. If you've been incarcerated, and remember, the drug trade was a large part of the underground economy that went on there. If you're incarcerated, you're an automatic exclude in Maryland for a job. I remember sitting on the desk one day and saying, well, why can't we get these people into jobs? And having a guy say, look, I'm out of jail. I'm straight, I'm sober, and if I don't get a job soon, something bad's going to happen. So what we had to do is try to go to get people to hire and to vouch for it. And so it gets you, and so we set up something that was never big enough in its size because it was costly to do, to vouchsafe that if something bad happened, if somebody didn't show up or something, you know, we would pay the cost of that, meaning enterprise. We started being able to place people. But the job side of things is really hard and it's really difficult. And in essence, it created, because basically people were hired into minimum wage jobs, which is fine. It's a start. But the moment that there was a setback in the economy, they all got laid off again. So, again, you have no savings. You have no – so
yeah, – they live paycheck to paycheck.
So it's paycheck to paycheck. And so the if I go back to the failures, you know, again, we turned those schools around, which were two of the schools that were there. But the big failure is the lack of connection to the global world that we're in today that is sucking jobs out of central cities. All those jobs are gone and putting them somewhere else. And a good standard of life in this country today really depends on the smarts that you have. Otherwise, you will be in a service-level job that barely pays for what you need to do. You know, a lot of these guys in Sandtown, the brightest guys, the leaders in them, you know, started looking at the economics of the drug trade versus the economics of service-level jobs and decided they'd take the risk of one versus the other. And so it's a huge issue, drug issue, job connection issue, sustainability is a huge issue. And out of that, if you go in there today, you will see really good housing. It astounds me, you know, 20, 30 years later. And the people that have been able to be there, that have been able to sustain it, are remarkable people. There never was a real rise in income of the area, and that's key. The schools got dramatically better, so the kids are being better educated, but they're still exposed to drugs on the streets. And the barriers to work are real barriers that exist. So anyway, Enterprise took a different way and worked with the Casey Foundation in looking at East Baltimore, where the real jobs for Baltimore are. The largest employer, which used to be Beth Steele, breweries, Westinghouse, today are Johns Hopkins Healthcare. It's your EDs and your meds. It's your universities and your medical facilities. And we took a survey in Johns Hopkins medical area and said, you know, two-thirds are entry-level jobs, but they pay and they have benefits. And where are those people coming from? Well, none of them were coming from the surrounding areas. Zero were coming from the surrounding areas. And the surrounding area to Johns Hopkins is blighted. It's half empty. It's dangerous, and it's really difficult. And there's a long term terrible relationship between the university and the surrounding neighborhoods because they would stockpile buildings to buffer themselves from crime in the surrounding areas, which, of course, the leaders in those neighborhoods hated. They became the places where the crime occurred because they were empty buildings, and they worried that Hopkins was just going to wipe them all out. None of it true back and forth perception and some reality. So anyway, that's where you ought to do a show on this, on East Baltimore Development Initiative, which took 72 square blocks, huge area in the heart, East Baltimore, near these jobs, and looked at fancy financing, tax increment financing, which basically said, we're going to put a big biotech building right next to Hopkins because it makes sense. There's lots of innovative companies, techniques, all coming out of Hopkins, a world-renowned institution, and they all go somewhere else. Why not have pharma companies, other companies right there, right next to Hopkins, so that there's a connection and so that the city keeps the property tax, it gets the small businesses, it gets the offshoots that are occurring.
And you hire local people.
And you hire local people. And you have an agreement with Hopkins to hire local people also for the entry-level jobs. And you make it fair to everyone with your replacement policies. And so Casey and Johns Hopkins University Enterprise was initially involved, isn't involved to any degree anymore. I was involved in the drawing it up because Casey really took it on so fully. And
explain what Casey is.
Oh, I'm sorry. The Annie Casey Foundation is a Baltimore-based foundation of, I think it's $5 billion the last I looked, in endowment that is working nationally, but also decided that it should do something locally, local to where it was based, to really try and find ways to use the jobs that exist and help the people that are in the cities really increase their quality of living, their standard of living, and their outlook on life, their ability in life. I really salute them for what they're taking on and doing. And they backed a tax increment financing, which all it means is if you put in this biotech and you put it right next to Hopkins and it pays taxes and the whole area improves from a property value, you're using all of those taxes over the longer run to pay for the upfront investment that you need to put in, because a lot of money needs to go into
this. Capital.
Yeah. Capital needs to go into that. And interestingly, Casey guaranteed the increment financing so that the capital could come in front end, and they believed enough that the area would increase in value, et cetera. So lots of lessons there. You ought to do another show with Chris Shea, who's over there and running that. It's remarkable. Of course, they started right as the 2008 crash started. But anyway, the biotech buildings are up and they're next door to Hopkins, and affordable housing is going in and higher income housing to mix that area. And there's a brand new school that is going in, which is a state-of-the-art school that Hopkins has really worked on, and the capital's been provided for that. And so it's really a long-term look at connecting to where there are jobs and will be jobs for the long run, to make sure that Hopkins could keep its high quality admissions. It's one of the best hospitals, healthcare, teaching institutions in the country. It was getting less of its best students because the parents would come and say, I'm not sure I want anyone to go here, because you could get
to live around there.
Yeah. Obviously, people that are going to work that hard want to live near where they're interns and they're studying, and doctors would benefit, but none of them could because the area was so bad and run down. This is, again, back to Jim Rouse. It's just reconnecting the points that are very difficult to do, but are very logical, that make sense, and we've just gotten away from it, and there's no money in it. So nobody takes it on. But it's what foundations ought to do. It's what city officials want to do. And this is to Martin O'Malley's great credit. He took on what we thought would be an impossible situation of getting the city council to declare eminent domain so no one could hold out on the 72 square acres. And it was unanimous. And so there had to be a political answer to it. There had to be a fairness thing under this eminent domain. Casey said, you're going to be better off no matter what the value of your house is. You're going to get $150,000 if you want to relocate, or you get to come back first in. For those of you who fought these wars, usually single women who had made this their home and who had survived, and, you know, one of the highest crime rates, one of the most difficult places, but their house was worth $30,000 under appraisal, but they couldn't get another place for $30,000. Mm-hmm. So they stepped in and they said, oh, you will be better off as a result of if you move, or you want to move, if you want to come back, you get first right. It's a really fascinating study of immense political capital, immense foundation capital. B of A did the financing on it. Of course, they were backstopped. And it's a long-term project, and it hits all the up and downs of the real estate cycle, et cetera. And so to me, if you just talk about Baltimore, we started in Sandtown, Winchester. We learned a lot. We weren't connected to where there were job areas. This is where there is connection to job areas, in another very devastated neighborhood. And these jobs will persist as long as Hopkins' health persists. Out of this, over the longer run, you get some wonderful examples that other cities in similar conditions that have to adjust to what's happened globally in the economic sphere can do and should do.
How do they translate, or will they currently, to other parts of the city? Now, of course, with the Hopkins one, you can't have pharmaceutical companies or whatever in every neighborhood and such like that. But there has to be a germ of an idea that can translate to other areas in terms of sustainability and growth for the new James Rouse Foundation from now for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Are there things that you see happening like that?
Well, it's interesting. University of Maryland actually looked at this and got it up and running first in their area. And they combined with Bond Secure Hospital. They're in some of the roughest parts of West Baltimore. And it's south of Sandtown, Winchester. It's closer to the University of Maryland. University of Maryland had never crossed over the sort of the highway, which was the dividing line between white and black in the city, and did. And it has biotech, and it got them up faster, and they're all occupied, and it worked with Bond Secure around its area. It's a medical facility, and Enterprise worked with them on it. And so that here's the same idea around meds and ads on the other side, on the west side of Baltimore. So it can't be everywhere.
Sure.
And you're going to have an awful situation where there is going to be some triage. There's not enough money to go around. There's not enough intellectual capital to go around all of Baltimore. But Baltimore itself, and I haven't kept up in recent administrations, but started to say we really need to plan and look at what will work and be sustainable here for the longer run in different parts of the city. So it's not every place, but it's places that may have jobs or may have small businesses that they think they could bring back in. And it'll be slightly different, but it's beginning to think of these connections of various jobs, education, housing. How do we take limited resources, what's happening in the world, and connect these things to make a difference?
Just to wrap it up, we just got a few minutes left. You retired in 2008. What are you doing currently, and what do you hope to do in the near future?
So currently, I was lucky enough to be able to pick the things that I really wanted to work on after retiring. And as I said, I was appointed to Fannie Mae's board. Fannie Mae, of course, is the largest financer. It's got $3 trillion in assets. I'd done lots of work with Fannie Mae on tax credits, on a lot of things over time. And I was really interested in what the future of our housing finance system was going to be. And of course, after 2008, actually, I turned over a little bit earlier in 2008, and everything was going well for Enterprise. I thought it was a good time to turn it over. It turned to be the sort of the high point, and then we hit this great recession, and Fannie Mae went bankrupt, basically. I was put in conservatorship. So by the time I joined that board, they were putting out over 1 million people a year, and I'd spent 23 of my years putting 240,000 people into houses, and yet there was 1 million going out the other way through foreclosures, et cetera. I was chair of strategic planning for the board of Fannie Mae to look at what was Fannie Mae's, Freddie Mac's culpability in this, what happened, how did it happen, and what do we learn from it? As I said, I'm a liberal, probably, if you want to coin something, but we had the CFO of Morgan Stanley on the job. So there were a number of Republicans and Democrats who wanted to look at the data of what had happened, how did it happen, et cetera. And I read 24 of the major books that came out about the crisis and what happened, et cetera. We wanted to learn, and I think the facts are pretty clear. You'll never see this because the ideology, one side or the other, really covers everything in papers and lots of things that have come out about Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, affordable housing, et cetera. But the facts are very clear, and both conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats on this board all believe, all came together in our beliefs after looking at all the data and the facts, was that there was no question but that the large financial institutions led the race to the bottom. They delivered $1.1 trillion of conduits that were poorly underwritten, and Fannie and Freddie allowed it to continue longer than it should have. They were very late in the game when they were getting put out of business. And so they have responsibility as well for this. The affordable housing goals were a small contributor because they were an excuse for them to do what they wanted to do anyway to get back in the game. However, it's really clear that the only reason Wall Street was doing what it was doing and financial institutions were doing what it was doing is it could make a lot of money doing it. It spread, and they spread it all over the world. And at some point, go look at Iceland and what happened. If it happens in Iceland, you know it's been all the way around the world. And there are wonderful books on this by Michael Lewis and others that will show you what happened. But the history is there's culpability on both sides, primarily on the large financial institutions, rating agencies, the mortgage brokers that sold to the investment banks, et cetera, et cetera. And it wasn't affordable housing or affordable housing goals that was a major contributor at all to any of this.
What we've talked about today, I'd like to do about a dozen other shows on it in more particular. Yeah. What I want to end with is you're currently on the board of Fannie Mae, right, and the Calvert Foundation and Blue Moon. Talk about the last two, Calvert Foundation and Blue Moon.
Just to finish that thought and I'll finish this off is to say – so the real things I want to make sure that we did everything possible to keep people in their homes if it made sense to do so from Fannie Mae's point of view and to see if there wasn't a housing finance system that didn't hurt the victims all over again. And that remains to be seen. The other two, the Calvert's Social Investment Foundation is providing resources around the world for jobs. And it's doing microfinance in India and in Bangladesh and in elsewhere where people need a small personal guarantee loan. And they can buy something that will sustain them. It's helping affordable housing in this country. It's helping small jobs. It's helping medical clinics get started. It's helping charter schools. So it's a wonderful, positive way of investing loan capital from people that are willing to make a loan for a purpose and will get paid back but will take a lower rate on their loan. We've raised $300 million plus. We'd like that to be several billion. That's where we're headed at Calvert. And Calvert's really a wonderful pioneer. Blue Moon Fund is doing environmental things around the world, and they are the most creative, most innovative, most interesting foundation I've ever been associated with. And I'll give you one for instance. They're making an equity investment in Bhutan in hazelnuts that is reforesting the sides of the hills, employing 15% of the population, raising their income three times, keeping them from going from rural into urban areas. This is with the blessing of the king of Bhutan, and making money on the other side by being a cost-effective supplier of hazelnuts into the European chocolate hazelnut market. And this is an investment that we'll make money on. And it's a phenomenal Stanford Chinese and American pair who are working with the Nobel Prize winner in biological tree clippings that are doing this. So these things are possible. They're incredible things that are possible. And we're working in Burma and in Peru and for lessons we've learned from the developed world in how to develop your resources and to help people grow.
I've been talking to Bart Harvey about his groundbreaking work with low-income housing, and he's retired, but he's still doing it now, and he's working with other initiatives. I want to thank you for being here on Baltimore Internet Radio.
Great, Dave, and good luck, and you're a good social entrepreneur as well.
Oh, so, thank you very much. I'm Dave Custy. You've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.